pretty closely.
"Who authorized that?" the president asked.
"I did," Jackson replied.
"Invading another country's airspace?"
"J2 and I are running this. You want us to know what they're up to and what their capabilities are, don't you?"
"Yes, I need that."
"Good. You tell me what to do and let me worry about how, all right? It's a stealthy platform. It self-destructs if it goes out of control or the guys directing it don't like something. And it gives us very good real-time data we can't get from satellites, or even from J-STARS. And we don't have one of those over there at the moment. Any other questions, Mr. President?"
"Touché, Admiral."
"What's the take look like?"
"They're looking better than our initial intelligence assessment led us to expect. Nobody's panicking yet, but this is starting to get our attention."
"What about Turkestan?" Ryan asked.
"They are evidently trying to get elections going, but that's old information, and that's all we know on the political side. The overall situation there is quiet at the moment. Satellites show increased cross-border traffic. Mainly trade, the overhead intelligence guys think. Nothing more than that.
Anybody looking at Iranian, damn, UIR troop dispositions on the border?"
"I don't know. I can check."
Jackson made a note.
"Next, we've spotted the Indian Navy."
"How?"
"They're not making a secret of anything.
I had them send a pair of Orions off from Diego Garcia.
They spotted our friends from 300 miles out, electronic emissions. They are about 400 miles offshore from their base. And, by the way, that places them directly between Diego and the entrance to the Persian Gulf. Our defense attaché will drop in tomorrow to ask what they're up to. They probably won't tell him very much.
If they don't, I think maybe Ambassador Williams will have to make a call of his own."
"Good idea. And that's the summary of today's news, unless you want the trivia."
Robbie tucked his documents away.
"What do your speeches look like?"
"The theme is common sense," the president reported.
"In Washington?"
Adler was not overly pleased. On arriving in Beijing, he'd learned that the timing wasn't good. His aircraft had gotten in on what had turned out to be a Saturday evening. The dateline again, he realized. Then he learned that the important ministers were out of town, studiously downplaying the significance of the air battle over the strait, and giving him a chance to recover from jet lag so that he would be up to a serious meeting. Or so they'd said.
"What a pleasure to have you here," the foreign minister said, taking the American's hand and guiding him into his private office. Another man was waiting in there.
"Do you know Zhang Hansan?"
"No, how do you do, minister?" Adler asked, taking his hand as well. So this was what he looked like.
People took their seats. Adler was alone. In addition to the two PRC ministers, there was an interpreter, a woman in her early 30s.
"Your flight was a pleasant one," the foreign minister inquired.
"Coming to your country is always pleasant, but I do wish the flight were faster," Adler admitted.
"The effects of travel on the body are often difficult, and the body does affect the mind. I trust you have had some time to recover."
"It is important," the foreign minister went on, "that high-level discussions, especially in times of unpleasantness, are not clouded by extraneous complications."
"I am well-rested," Adler assured them.
He'd gotten plenty of sleep. It was just that he wasn't sure what time it was in whatever location his body thought itself to be. And the interests of peace and stability compel us to make the occasional sacrifice.
"That is so true."
"Minister, the unfortunate events of the last week have troubled my country," Sextate told his hosts.
"Why do those bandits seek to provoke us?" the foreign minister asked.
"Our forces are conducting exercises, that is all. And they shot down two of our aircraft. The crewmen are all dead. They have families. This is very sad, but I hope you have noted that the People's Republic has not retaliated."
"We have noted this with gratitude."
"The bandit shot first. You also know that."
"We are unclear on that issue.
"One of the reasons for my coming here is to ascertain the facts," Adler replied.
"Ah."
Had he surprised them, Sextate wondered. It was like a card game, though the difference was that you never really knew the value of the cards in your own hand. A flush still beat a straight, but the whole card was always down, even for its owner. In this case, he had lied, but while the other side might suspect the lie, they didn't know for sure, and that affected the game. If they thought he knew, they would say one thing. If they thought he didn't know, they'd say another. In this case, they thought he knew, but they weren't sure. He'd just told them otherwise, which could be a lie or the truth. Advantage, America. Adler had thought about this all the way over.
"You have said publicly that the first shot was taken by the other side. Are you sure of this?"
"Completely," the foreign minister assured him.
"Excuse me, but what if the shot were taken by one of your lost pilots?
How would we ever know?"
"Our pilots were under strict orders not to fire except in self-defense."
"That is both a reasonable and prudent guide for your personnel. But in the heat of battle, or if not battle, a somewhat tense situation, mistakes do happen. We have the problem ourselves. I find aviators to be impulsive, especially the young, proud ones."
"Is not the same true of the other side as well?" the foreign minister asked.
"Certainly," Adler admitted. "That is the problem, isn't it?" "Which is why," he went on, "it is the business of people like ourselves to ensure that such situations do not arise."
"But they always provoke us. They hope to garner your favor, and we find it troubling that this may have succeeded."
"Excuse me?"
"Your President Ryan spoke of two Chinas."
"There is only one China, Secretary Adler. I thought that issue settled a long time ago."
"That was a semantic error on the President's part, a linguistic nuance," Adler replied, dismissing the observation. "The President has many qualities, but he has yet to learn the niceties of diplomatic exchange. And then a foolish reporter seized on the issue."
"Nothing more than that. There have been no changes in our policies toward this region."
But Adler had deliberately said "our policies" and "have been" instead of "are." There were times when he thought that he might have made a fortune for himself by drafting insurance policies.
"Such linguistic errors can be seen as things other than errors," the foreign minister replied. "Have I not made our position clear on this issue? You will recall that he was responding to a most unfortunate incident in which American lives were lost, and in searching for words to use, he selected words which have one meaning in our language and another in yours." This was going a lot easier than he'd expected.
"Chinese lives were lost as well."
Zhang, Adler saw, was doing a lot of listening but wasn't uttering a single word. In the Western context, that made him an aide, a technical assistant, there to assist his minister on an issue of law or interpretation. He wasn't so sure that rule applied in this case. More likely, the reverse applied. If Zhang were what the American thought him to be, and if Zhang were smart enough to suspect that the American would be thinking along those lines, then why the hell was he here?
"Yes, and various others, to little purpose and great sorrow. I hope you will understand that our President takes such things seriously."
"Indeed. And I am remiss in not saying sooner that we view with horror the attack on his daughter. I trust you will convey to President Ryan our heartfelt sympathy at this inhuman act, and our pleasure that no harm has come to his child."
"I thank you on his behalf, and I will pass your good wishes along."
Twice in a row now, the foreign minister had temporized. He had an opening. He reminded himself that his interlocutors thought themselves smarter and shrewder than everybody else.
"My president is a sentimental man," the secretary admitted. "It is an American trait. Moreover, he feels strongly about his duty to protect all of our citizens."
"Then you need to speak to the rebels on Taiwan. We believe that it is they who destroyed the airliner."
"But why do such a thing?" Adler asked. ignoring the really surprising part. Was it a slip?
Talk to Taiwan. The PRC was asking him to do that.
To foment this incident, obviously. To play upon your president's personal feelings. To cloud the real issues between the People's Republic and our wayward province.
Do you really think so?
Yes, we do, the foreign minister assured him.
We do not wish to have hostilities. Such things are so wasteful of people and resources, and we have greater concerns for our country. The Taiwan issue will be decided in due course, so long as America does not interfere, he added.
As I have already told you, Minister, we have made no policy changes. All we wish is the restoration of peace and stability, Adler said, the obvious import being the indeterminate maintenance of the status quo, which was decidedly not part of the People's Republic game plan.
Then we are agreed.
You will not object to our naval deployments? The foreign minister sighed.
The sea is free for the innocent passage of all. It is not our place to give orders to the United States of America, as it is not your place to give orders to the People's Republic. The movement of your forces gives the impression that you will influence local events, and we will make pro forma comments on this. But in the interests of peace, he went on in a voice that was both patient and weary, we will not object too strongly, especially if it encourages the rebels to cease their foolish provocations.
It would be useful to know if your naval exercises will end soon. That would be a very favorable gesture.
The spring maneuvers will continue. They do not threaten anyone, as your increased naval presence will determine quite clearly.
We do not ask you to take our word. Let our deeds speak for us. It would be well also if our rebellious cousins reduce their own activities.
Perhaps you might speak to them on this?
Twice now. He hadn't misspoken before then. If you request it, yes, I would be pleased to add my voice and that of my country to the quest for peace.
We value the good offices of the United States, and we trust you to be an honest broker for this occasion, in view of the fact that, regrettably, American lives were lost in this tragic incident.
Secretary Adler yawned.
Oh, excuse me.
Travel is a curse, is it not?
These words came from Zhang, speaking for the first time. It truly can be, Adler agreed. Please allow me to consult my government. I think our response to your request will be favorable.
Excellent, the foreign minister observed. We seek to make no precedent here. I hope you understand this. But in view of the singular circumstances here, we welcome your assistance.
I shall have a reply for you in the morning, Adler promised, rising. Forgive me for extending your day.
Such is duty for all of us.
Scott Adler took his leave, wondering what exactly this bombshell was that had landed on him. He wasn't sure who'd won the card game, and realized that he wasn't even sure what game it had been. It certainly hadn't gone as expected. It seemed like he'd won, and won easily. The other side had been more accommodating than he would have been in their place. Some called it checkbook journalism, but it wasn't new, and it wasn't expensive at the working level. Any experienced reporter had people he could call, people who, for a modest fee, would check things. It wasn't in any way illegal to ask a favor of a friend, at least not grossly so. The information was rarely sensitive, and in this case was public record. It was just that the offices weren't always open on Sunday. A mid-level bureaucrat in the office of Maryland's Secretary of State drove into his office in Baltimore, used his card pass to get to his parking place, then walked in and unlocked the right number of doors until he got to a musty file room. Finding the right cabinet, he pulled open a drawer and found a file. He left a marker in the drawer and carried the file to the nearest copying machine. Copies of all the documents were made in less than a minute, and then he replaced everything. With that task done, he walked back to his car and drove home. He did this often enough that he had a personal fax machine at home, and within 10 minutes the documents had been sent off, then taken to the kitchen and dumped in the trash. For this he would receive $500. He got extra for working weekends. John Plummer was reading the documents even before the transmission was complete. Sure enough, Orion, John P., had established a sub-S corporation at the time Holtzman had told him. Control of that corporation had conveyed to Zimmer, Carroll, Nunn, 4 days later, a weekend had stood in the way, and that corporation now owned a 7-Eleven in southern Maryland. The corporate officers included Zimmer, Lawrence, Zimmer, Alicia, and one other child, and the stockholders all shared the last surname. He recognized Ryan's signature on the transfer documents. The legal work had been done by a firm in Washington, a big one. He knew that name, too. There had been some tricky but entirely legal maneuvering to make the transaction tax-free for the Zimmer family. There was no further paperwork on that subject. Nothing else was needed, really. He had other documents as well. Plummer knew the registrar at MIT, and had learned the previous evening, also via fax, that the tuition and housing expenses for Peter Zimmer were paid by a private foundation, the checks issued and signed by a partner in the same law firm that had set up the Sub-S Corp for the Zimmer family. He even had a transcript for the graduating senior. Sure enough, he was in computer science, and would be staying in Cambridge for his graduate work in the MIT Media Lab. Aside from mediocre marks in his freshman literature courses, even MIT wanted people to be literate, but evidently Peter Zimmer didn't care for poetry. The kid was straight A. So it's true. Plummer settled back in his swivel chair and examined his conscience. "Why should I trust you, your reporters?" he repeated to himself. The problem with his profession was one that its members almost never talked about, just as a wealthy man will not often bemoan low taxes. Back in the 1960s, a man named Sullivan had sued the New York Times over defamation of character, and had demonstrated that the newspaper had not been entirely correct in its commentary. But the paper had argued, and the court had agreed, that in the absence of true malice, the mistake was not really culpable, and that the public's interest in learning the goings-on in their nation superseded protection of an individual. It left the door open for suits, technically, and people did still bring action against the media, and sometimes they even won, about as often as Slippery Rock University knocked off Penn State. That court ruling was necessary, Plummer thought. The First Amendment guaranteed freedom of the press, and the reason for it was that the press was America's first, and in many ways only, guardian of freedom. People lied all the time, especially people in government, but others too, and it was the job of the media to get the facts, the truth, out to the people, so that they could make their own choices. But there was a trap built into the hunting license the Supreme Court had issued. The media could destroy people. There was recourse against almost any improper action in American society, but reporters had such protections as those once enjoyed by kings, and as a practical matter, his profession was above the law. As a practical matter also, it worked hard to stay that way. To admit error was not only a legal faux pas for which money might have to be paid. It would also weaken the faith of the public in their profession. And so they never admitted error when they didn't have to, and when they did, the retractions were almost never given the prominence of the initial incorrect assertions, the minimum necessary effort defined by lawyers who knew exactly the height of the castle walls they defended. There were occasional exceptions, but everyone knew that exceptions they were. Plummer had seen his profession change. There was too much arrogance and too little realization of the fact that the public they served no longer trusted them. And that wounded Plummer. He deemed himself worthy of that trust. He deemed himself a professional descendant of Ed Murrow, whose voice every American had learned to trust. And that was how it was supposed to be. But it wasn't, because the profession could not be policed from without, and it would never be trusted again until it was policed from within. Reporters called down every other profession, medicine, law, politics, for failing to meet a level of professional responsibility which they would allow no one to enforce on themselves, and which they themselves would too rarely enforce on their own. "Do as I say, not as I do," was something you couldn't say to a 6-year-old, but it had become a ready cant for grown-ups. And if it got any worse, then what? Plummer considered his situation. He could retire whenever he wanted. Columbia University had more than once invited him in to be an adjunct professor of journalism and ethics, because his was a trusted voice, a reasoned voice, an honest voice. An old voice, he added to himself. Maybe the last voice. But it all came down really to one man's conscience, to ideas inculcated by parents long dead, and teachers whose names he had forgotten. He had to be loyal to something. If he were to be loyal to his profession, then he had to be loyal to its foundation. To tell the truth and let the chips fall, he lifted his phone. "Holtzman," the reporter answered, because it was the business line in his Georgetown home. "Plummer, I've done some checking. It appears you were right." "Okay. Now what, John?" "I have to do this myself. I'll give you the exclusive on print coverage." "That's generous, John. Thank you," Bob acknowledged. "I still don't like Ryan very much as a president," Plummer added, rather defensively, the other thought. That made sense. He couldn't appear to be doing this to curry favor. "You know that's not what this is about. That's why I talked to you about it." "When?" Bob Holtzman asked. "Tomorrow night, live." "How about we sit down and work out a few things? This will be a biggie for the Post. Want to share the byline?" "I might just be looking for another job by tomorrow night," Plummer observed with a rueful chuckle. "Okay, we'll do that." "So what's that mean?" Jack asked. "They do not mind anything we're doing. It's almost like they want the carrier there. They have requested that I shuttle back and forth to Taipei."
"Directly?"
The president was astonished. Such direct flights would give the appearance of legitimacy to the Republic of China government. An American Secretary of State would be shuttling back and forth, and a ministerial official did so only between capitals of sovereign countries. Lesser disputes were left to special envoys, who might carry the same power, but nothing approaching the same status.
"Yeah, that kind of surprised me, too," Adler replied over the encrypted channel. "Next, the dogs that didn't bark. A cursory objection to your 2 Chinas gaffe at the press conference, and trade never raised its ugly head. They're being real docile for people who killed 100-plus airline passengers."
"Their naval exercises?"
"They will continue, and they practically invited us to observe how routine they are."
Admiral Jackson was listening on the speakerphone.
"Mr. Secretary, this is Robbie Jackson."
"Yes, Admiral."
"They staged a crisis. We move a carrier. And now they say they want us around? Am I getting this right?"
"That's correct. They do not know that we know, at least I don't think they do. But you know, I'm not sure that matters at the moment."
"Something's wrong," the J-3 said immediately. "Big time wrong."
"Admiral, I think you might be correct on that one, too."
"Next move?" Ryan asked.
"I guess I go to Taipei in the morning. I can't evade this one, can I?"
"Agreed. Keep me informed, Scott."
"Yes, Mr. President."
The line went dead.
"Jack."
"No, Mr. President, I just had a big red flashing light go off." Ryan grimaced.
"I have to go be political tomorrow, too. I fly out at, he checked his schedule. Leave the house at 6:50 to speak in Nashville at 8:30. We need an assessment on this in one big hurry. Shit, Adler's over there, I'm on the road, and Ben Goodley isn't experienced enough for this. I want you there, Rob. If there's operational ramifications to this, that's your bailiwick. The Foleys. Arnie on the political side. We need a good China hand from state.
Adler was settling into his bed in the embassy VIP quarters. He went over his notes, trying to figure the angle. People made mistakes at every level. The wide belief that senior officials were canny players was not nearly as true as people thought. They made mistakes. They made slips. They loved to be clever.
"Travel is a curse," Zhang had said. His only words. Why then, and why those? It was so obvious that Adler didn't get it then.
"Bedford Forest, eh?" Diggs said, spreading relish on his hot dog.
"Best cavalry commander we've ever had," Eddington said.
"You'll pardon me, Professor, if I show diminished enthusiasm for the gentleman," the general observed. "The son of a bitch did found the Ku Klux Klan."
"I never said the man was politically astute, sir, and I do not defend his personal character. But if we've ever had a better man with a cavalry command, I have not learned his name," Eddington replied.
"He's got us there," Ham had to admit.
"Stuart was overrated, sometimes petulant, and very lucky. Nathan had the finger spitzengefühl, knew how to make decisions on the fly, and damned if he made many bad ones. I'm afraid we just have to overlook his other failings."
History discussions among senior army officers could last for hours, as this one had, and were as learned as those in any university's seminar room. Diggs had come over for a chat with Colonel Ham, then found himself embroiled in the millionth refighting of the Civil War.
Millionth? Diggs wondered. No, a lot more than that.
What about Grierson? Diggs asked.
His deep raid was a thing of beauty. But he didn't actually conceive it, remember. Actually, I think his best work was as commander of the 10th.
Now you're talking, Dr. Eddington.
See how the boss's eyes just lit up, you...
Well, that's right, you had that regiment until a little while ago.
Ready and forward, the colonel of the Carolina Guard added.
You even know our regimental motto?
Maybe this guy was a serious historian after all, even if he did admire that racist murderer, Diggs thought.
Grierson built that regiment from the ground up, mainly illiterate troopers. He had to grow his own NCOs, and they drew every shit job in the Southwest. But they're the ones who defeated the Apaches, and only one damn movie ever made about them. I've been thinking about a book on the subject after I retire. He was our first real desert fighter, and he figured things out in a hurry. He knew about deep strike. He knew how to pick his fights. And once he got hold, he didn't let go. I was glad to see that regimental standard come back.
Colonel Eddington, I take back what I was thinking.
Diggs lifted his beer can in salute.
That's what the Cav is all about.
Chapter 46 Outbreak. It would have been better to come back Monday morning, but it would have meant getting the kids up too early. As it was, Jack Jr. and Sally had to study for tests, and for the moment Katie needed new arrangements of her own. Camp David had been so different, it was very much like returning from a vacation, and coming back was something of a shock. As soon as the executive mansion appeared in the windows of the descending helicopter, faces and moods changed. Security was vastly increased. The body count around the perimeter was noticeably different, and that, too, was a reminder of how undesirable this place and the life it contained were for them. Ryan stepped off first, saluted the Marine at the bottom of the stairs, then looked up at the south face of the White House. It was like a slap in the face. Welcome back to reality. After seeing his family safely inside, President Ryan headed west for his office.
"Okay, what's happening?" he asked Van Damme, who hadn't had much of a weekend himself. But then nobody was trying to kill him or his family either.
"The investigation hasn't turned up much of anything yet. Murray says to be patient. Things are happening. Best advice, Jack, just keep going with it, the chief of staff advised. You have a full day tomorrow. The country's mood is for you. There's always an outpouring of sympathy in times like... Arnie, I'm not going out after votes for myself, remember? It's nice that people think better of me after some terrorists attack my daughter, but, you know, I really don't want to look at things in those terms, Jack observed, his anger returning after 2 days of relief. If I ever had thoughts about staying in this job, last week cured me. Well, yes, but hell. Arnie, when it's all said and done, what will I take away from this place? A place in the history books? By the time that's written, I'll be dead, and I won't be around to care what historians say, will I? I have a friend in the history business who says that all history is really nothing more than the application of ideology to the past, and I won't be around to read it anyway. The only thing I want to take away from here is my life and the lives of my family. That's all. If somebody else wants the pomp and circumstance of this fucking prison, then let 'em have it. I've learned better. Fine, POTUS said bitterly, his mood totally back in his office now. I'll do the job, make the speeches, and try to get some useful work done. But it ain't worth it all, Arnie. For goddamn sure it isn't worth having 9 terrorists try to kill your daughter. There's only one thing you leave behind on this planet. That's your kids. Everything else, hell, other people just make it up to suit themselves anyway, just like the news. It's been a rough couple of days, and what about the agents who died? What about their families? I had a nice 2-day vacation. They sure as hell didn't. I've gotten used enough to this job that I hardly thought about them at all. Over 100 people worked hard to make sure I forgot about it. And I let them do it. It's important that I don't dwell on such things, right? What am I supposed to concentrate on? Duty? Honor? Country? Anybody who can do that and turn his humanity off doesn't belong here, and that's what this job is turning me into. You finished, or do I have to get a box of Kleenex for you? For one brief moment, the president looked ready to punch Van Damme. Arnie plunged on. Those agents died because they chose jobs they thought were important. Soldiers do the same thing. What's with you anyway, Ryan? How the hell do you think a country happens? You think it's just nice thoughts? You weren't always that stupid. You were a Marine once. You did other stuff for CIA. You had balls then. You have a job. You didn't get drafted, remember? You volunteered for this, whether you admit it or not. You knew it was possible this would happen. And so now you're here. You want to run away? Fine, run away. But don't tell me it isn't worth it. Don't tell me it doesn't matter. If people died to protect your family, don't you fucking dare tell me it doesn't matter. Van Damme stormed out of the office without even bothering to close the door behind him. Ryan didn't know what to do right then. He sat down behind his desk. There were the usual piles of paper, neatly arrayed by a staff that never slept. Here was China. Here was the Middle East. Here was India. Here was advance information on the leading economic indicators. Here were political projections for the 161 House seats to be decided in 2 days. Here was a report on the terrorist incident. Here was a list of the names of the dead agents, and under each was a list of wives and husbands, parents and children, and in the case of Don Russell, grandchildren. He knew all the faces, but Jack had to admit that he hadn't remembered all the names. They'd died to protect his child, and he didn't even know all the names. Worst of all, he'd allowed himself to be carted away, to indulge himself in yet more artificial comfort, and forget. But here it all was, on his desk, waiting for him, and it wouldn't go away. And he couldn't run away either. He stood and walked out the door, heading left for the chief of staff's corner office, passing Secret Service agents who'd heard the exchange, probably traded looks, certainly developed their own thoughts, and now concealed them. Arnie? Yes, Mr. President? I'm sorry. Okay, honey, he groaned. He'd go to see the doctor tomorrow morning. It hadn't gotten better at all. If anything, it had gotten worse. The headaches were punishing, and that despite 2 extra-strength Tylenol every 4 hours. If only he could sleep it off, but that was proving hard. Only exhaustion allowed him an hour here and an hour there. Just getting up to use the bathroom required a few minutes of concentrated effort. Enough that his wife offered to help. But no, a man didn't need an escort for that. On the other hand, she was right. He did need to see a doctor. Would have been smarter to do it yesterday, he thought. Then he might have felt better now. It had been easy for Plummer, at least on the procedural side. The tape storage vault was the size of a respectable public library, and finding things was easy. There, on the 5th shelf, were 3 boxed beta-format cassettes. Plummer took them down, removed the tapes from the boxes, and replaced them with blanks. The 3 tapes he placed in his briefcase. He was home 20 minutes later. There, for his own convenience, he had a commercial-type Betamax, and he ran the tapes of the first interview just to make sure, just to confirm the fact that the tapes were undamaged. And they were. These would have to be sent to a secure place. Next, John Plummer drafted his 3-minute commentary piece for the next day's evening news broadcast. It would be a mildly critical piece on the Ryan presidency. He spent an hour on it, since, unlike the current crop of TV reporters, he liked to achieve a certain elegance in his language, a task which came easily to him, as his grammar was correct. This he printed up and read over because he both edited and detected errors more easily on paper than on a computer monitor. Satisfied, he copied the piece over to disk, which would later be used at the studio to generate copy for the teleprompter. Next, he composed another commentary piece of the same overall length. It turned out to be 4 words shorter, and that he printed also. Plummer spent rather more time with this one. If it were to be his professional swan song, then it had to be done properly. And this reporter, who had drafted quite a few obituaries for others, both admired and not, wanted his own to be just right. Satisfied with the final copy, he printed that up as well, tucking the pages into his briefcase with the cassettes. This one he would not copy to disk. "I guess they're finished," the Chief Master Sergeant said. The take from the Predator showed the tank columns heading back to their loggers, hatches open on the turrets, crewmen visible, mainly smoking. The exercise had gone well for the newly constituted UIR Army, and even now they were conducting their road movements in good order. Major Sabah spent so much time looking over this man's shoulder that they really should have spoken on a more informal basis, he thought. It was all routine. Too routine. He'd expected, hoped, that his country's new neighbor would require much more time to integrate its military forces. But the commonality of weapons and doctrine had worked in their favor. Radio messages copied down here and at Storm Track suggested that the exercise was concluded. The TV coverage from the UAV confirmed it, however, and confirmation was important. "That's funny," the sergeant observed, to his own surprise. "What is it?" Sabah asked. "Excuse me, sir." The NCO stood and walked over to a corner cabinet, from which he extracted a map, and brought it back to his workstation. "There's no road there. Look, sir." He unfolded the map, matched the coordinates with those on the screen. The Predator had its own global positioning satellite navigation system and automatically told its operators where it was, and tapped the right section on the paper. "See?" The Kuwaiti officer looked back and forth from map to screen. On the latter, there was a road now, but that was easily explained. A column of 100 tanks would convert almost any surface into a hard-packed highway of sorts, and that had happened here. But there hadn't been a road there before. The tanks had made it over the last few hours. That's a change, Major. The Iraqi army was always road-bound before.
Sabah nodded. It was so obvious that he hadn't seen it.
Though native to the desert, and supposedly schooled in traveling there, the Iraqi army in 1991 had connived at its own destruction by sticking close to roads, because its officers always seemed to get lost when moving cross-country. Not as mad as it sounded. The desert was essentially as featureless as the sea. It had made their movements predictable, never a good thing in a war, and given advancing Allied forces free rein to approach from unexpected directions. That had just changed.
"You suppose they have GPS, too?" the Chief Master Sergeant asked.
"We couldn't expect them to stay stupid forever, could we?"
President Ryan kissed his wife on the way to the elevator. The kids weren't up yet. One sort of work lay ahead. Another sort lay behind. Today there wasn't time for both, though some efforts would be made. Ben Goodley was waiting on the helicopter.
"Here's the notes from Adler on his Tehran trip." The National Security Advisor passed them over.
"Also the write-up from Beijing. The working group is getting together at 10 to go over that situation. The SNI team will be meeting at Langley later today, too."
"Thanks."
Jack strapped into his seat and started reading. Arnie and Callie came aboard and took their seats forward of his.
"Any ideas, Mr. President?" Goodley asked.
"Ben, you're supposed to tell me, remember?"
"How about I tell you that it doesn't make much sense?"
"I already know that part. You guard the phones and faxes today. Scott should be in Taipei now. Whatever comes from him, fast-track it to me."
"Yes, sir."
The helicopter lurched aloft. Ryan hardly noticed that. His mind was on the job, crummy though it was. Price and Raymond were with him. There would be more agents on the 747, and more still waiting even now in Nashville. The presidency of John Patrick Ryan went on, whether he liked it or not. This country might be small, might be unimportant, might be a pariah in the international community, not because of anything it had done, except, perhaps, to prosper, but because of its larger and less prosperous neighbor to the west. But it did have an elected government, and that was supposed to count for something in the community of nations, especially those with popularly elected governments themselves. The People's Republic had come to exist by force of arms. Well, most countries did, Sextate reminded himself, and had immediately thereafter slaughtered millions of its own citizens. Nobody knew how many. Nobody was terribly interested in finding out. Launched into a revolutionary development program, the Great Leap Forward, which had turned out more disastrously than was the norm even for Marxist nations, and launched yet another internal reform effort, the Cultural Revolution, which had come after something called the Hundred Flowers Campaign, whose real purpose had been to smoke out potential dissidents for later elimination at the hands of students whose revolutionary enthusiasm had indeed been revolutionary toward Chinese culture. They'd come close to destroying it entirely, in favor of the Little Red Book. Then had come more reform, the supposed changeover from Marxism to something else, another student revolution, this one against the existing political system, arrogantly cut down with tanks and machine guns on global television. Despite all that, the rest of the world was entirely willing to let the People's Republic crush their cousins on Taiwan. This was called Realpolitik, Scott Adler thought. Something similar had resulted in an event called the Holocaust, an event his father had survived, with a number tattooed on his forearm to prove it. Even his own country officially had a one-China policy, though the unspoken codicil was that the PRC would not attack the ROC. And if it did, then America might just react. Or might not. Adler was a career diplomat, a graduate of Cornell and the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy at Tufts University. He loved his country.
He was often an instrument of his country's policy, and now found himself to be his country's very voice of international affairs. But what he often had to say was not terribly just, and at moments like this, he wondered if he might himself be doing the same things that had been done 60 years earlier by other Fletcher grads, well-educated and well-meaning, who, after it was all over, wondered how the hell they'd been so blind as not to have seen it coming.
"We have fragments, and actually some rather large pieces from the missile that were lodged in the wing. It is definitely of PRC origin," the ROC defense minister said. "We will allow your technical people to look them over and make your own tests to confirm matters."
"Thank you. I will discuss that with my government."
So, this was the foreign minister. "They allow a direct flight from Beijing to Taipei. They do not object privately to the dispatch of an aircraft carrier. They disclaim any responsibility for the Airbus incident. I confess I see no rationale for this behavior. I am gratified that they express interest only in the restoration of regional stability."
"How good of them," Defense said, "after they deliberately upset it. This has caused us great economic harm. Again, foreign investors get nervous, and with the flight of their capital, we face some minor embarrassments. Was that their plan, do you suppose?"
"Minister, if that were the case, why did they ask me to fly here directly?"
"Some manner of subterfuge, obviously," the foreign minister answered, before Defense could say anything.
"But if so, what for?" Adler wanted to know. "Hell, they were Chinese. Maybe they could figure it out."
"We are secure here. We know that, even if foreign investors do not. Even so, the situation is not an entirely happy one. It is rather like living in a castle with a moat. Across the moat is a lion. The lion would kill and eat us if he had the chance. He cannot leap the moat, and he knows that, but he keeps trying to do so, even with that knowledge. I hope you can understand our concern."
"I do, sir," Sextate assured him. "If the PRC reduces the level of its activity, will you do the same?" Even if they couldn't figure out what the PRC was up to, perhaps they could de-stress the situation anyway.
"In principle, yes. Exactly how is a technical question for my colleague here. You will not find us unreasonable."
And the entire trip had been staged for that simple statement. Now Adler had to fly back to Beijing to deliver it. Matchmaker, matchmaker. Hopkins had its own daycare center, staffed by permanent people and always some students from the university doing lab work for their childcare major. Sally walked in, looked around, and was pleased by the multicolored environment. Behind her were 4 agents, all male, because there weren't any unassigned women. 1 carried a fag bag. Nearby was a trio of plainclothes officers of the Baltimore City Police, who exchanged credentials with the USSS to confirm identity. And so another day started for Surgeon and Sandbox. Katie had enjoyed the helicopter ride. Today she'd make some new friends, but tonight, her mother knew, she'd ask where Miss Marlene was. How did one explain death to a not-yet 3-year-old? The crowd applauded with something more than the usual warmth. Ryan could feel it. Here he was, not yet 3 days after an attempt on the life of his youngest daughter, doing his job for them, showing strength and courage and all that other bullshit, POTUS thought. He'd led off with a prayer for the fallen agents, and Nashville was the Bible Belt, where such things were taken seriously. The rest of the speech had actually been pretty good, the president thought, covered things he really believed in. Common sense, honesty, duty. It was just that hearing his own voice speaking words written by somebody else made it seem hollow, and it was hard to keep his mind from wandering so early in the morning.
"Thank you. And God bless America," he concluded.
The crowd stood and cheered. The band struck up. Ryan turned away from the armored podium to shake hands again with the local officials. and made his way off the stage, waving as he did so. Arnie was waiting behind the curtain.
"For a phony, you still do pretty good."
Ryan didn't have time to respond to that before Andrea came up. "Flash traffic waiting for you on the bird, sir, from Mr. Adler."
"Okay, let's roll. Stay close," he told his principal agent on the way out the back.
"Always," Price assured him.
"Mr. President," a reporter shouted.
There were a bunch of them. He was the loudest this morning. He was one of the NBC team. Ryan turned and stopped.
"Will you press Congress for a new gun control law?"
"What for?"
"The attack on your daughter was..."
Ryan held his hand up.
"Okay, as I understand it, the weapons used were of a type already illegal. I don't see how a new law would accomplish much, unfortunately. But gun control advocates say..."
"I know what they say.
And now they're using an attack on my little girl and the deaths of five superb Americans to advance a political agenda of their own.
What do you think of that?" the president asked, turning away.
"What's the problem?"
He described his symptoms. His family physician was an old friend. They even played golf together. It wasn't hard. At the end of every year, the Cobra representative had plenty of demonstrator clubs in nearly mint condition. Most were donated to youth programs or sold to country clubs as rental sticks. But some he could give to his friends, not to mention some Greg Norman autographs.
"Well, you have a temperature, 103, and that's a little high. Your BP's 100/65, and that's a little low for you.
Your color's rotten."
"I know, I feel sick."
"You are sick, but I wouldn't worry about it. Probably a flu bug you picked up in some bar, and all the air travel doesn't help much either. And I've been telling you for years about cutting back on the booze. What happened is you picked something up, and other factors worsened it. Started Friday, right?"
"Thursday night. Maybe Friday morning."
"Played around anyway?"
"Ended up with a snowman for my trouble," he admitted, meaning a score of 80.
"I'd settle for that myself, healthy and stone sober."
The doctor had a handicap of 20.
"You're over 50, and you can't wallow with the pigs at night and expect to soar with the eagles in the morning. Complete rest. A lot of liquids, non-alcoholic. Stay on the Tylenol."
"No prescription?"
The doc shook his head.
"Antibiotics don't work on viral infections. Your immune system has to handle those, and it will if you let it. But while you're here, I want to draw some blood. You're overdue for a cholesterol check. I'll send my nurse in. You have somebody here to drive you home?"
"Yeah, I didn't want to drive myself."
"Good. Give it a few days. Cobra can do without you, and the golf courses will still be there when you feel better."
"Thanks."
He felt better already.
"You always did when the doc told you that you weren't going to die."
"Here you go." Goodley handed the paper over. Few office buildings, even secure government ones, had the communications facilities that were shoehorned into the upper-level lounge area of the VC-25, whose call sign was Air Force One.
"Not bad news at all," Ben added.
Swordsman skimmed it once, then sat down to read it more slowly.
"Okay, fine. He thinks he can defuse the situation," Ryan noted. "But he still doesn't know what the goddamn situation is."
"Better than nothing."
"Does the working group have this?"
"Yes, Mr. President."
"Maybe they can make some sense out of it.
Andrea?"
"Yes, Mr. President."
"Tell the driver it's time to get moving." He looked around.
"Where's Arnie?"
"I'm calling you on a cellular," Plummer said.
"Fine," Van Damme replied. "I'm on one, too, as a matter of fact."
The instruments on the aircraft were also secure, with STU-4 capability. He didn't say that. He just needed a retort. John Plummer was no longer on his Christmas card list. Unfortunately, his direct line was still on Plummer's Rolodex. What a shame he couldn't change it. And he'd have to tell his secretary not to put this guy through anymore, at least not when he was traveling.
"I know what you're thinking. Good, John, then I don't have to say what I think.
Catch the broadcast tonight. I'll be on at the end.
Why?
See for yourself, Arnie. So long.
The chief of staff thumbed the kill switch on the phone and wondered what Plummer meant. He'd once trusted the man. Hell, he'd once trusted the man's colleague. He could have told the president about the call, but decided not to. He'd just delivered a pretty good speech, distractions and all, doing well in spite of himself, because the poor son of a bitch really did believe in more than he knew. It wouldn't be smart to drop something else on him. They'd tape the speech on the flight into California, and if it were fit to view, then he'd show it to POTUS.
"I didn't know there was a flu bug around," he said, putting his shirt back on. It took time. The auto executive was sore all over.
"There always is. Just it doesn't always make the news," the physician replied, looking over the vital signs his nurse had just written down.
"And you got it."
"So?"
"So, take it easy. Don't go to the office. No sense infecting your whole company. Write it out. You should be fine by the end of the week."
The SNI team met at Langley. A ton of new information had come across from the Persian Gulf region, and they were sorting through it in a conference room on the sixth floor. Chavez's photo of Mahmoud Haji Dariai had been blown up by the in-house photo lab and was now hanging on the wall. Maybe somebody would throw darts at it, Ding thought.
"Tractodes," the former infantryman snorted, watching the Predator video.
"Kinda big to take on with a rifle, Sundance," Clark observed. "Those things always scared the hell out of me."
"Laws rocket'll do 'em fine, Mr. C."
"What's the range on a Laws, Domingo?"
400-500 meters.
"Those guns shoot 2 or 3 kilometers," John pointed out. "Think about it."
"I'm not up on the hardware," Bert Vasco said. He waved at the screen. "What's this mean?"
The answer came from one of CIA's military analysts. "It means the UIR military is in much better shape than we'd expected." An Army major brought over from the Defense Intelligence Agency didn't dispute that.
"I'm fairly impressed. It was a pretty vanilla exercise, nothing really complicated on the maneuver side, but they kept themselves organized for all of it. Nobody got lost."
"You suppose they're using GPS now?" the CIA analyst asked.
"Anybody who subscribes to Yachting Magazine can buy the things. The price is down to $400 last time I looked," the officer told his civilian counterpart.
"It means they can navigate their mobile forces a lot better. More than that, it means their artillery will become a whole lot more effective. If you know where your guns are, where your forward observer is, and where the target is in relation to him, then your first round is going to be pretty much on the money."
"Fourfold increase in performance?"
"Easy," the major replied.
"That elderly gent on the wall has a big stick to wave at his neighbors. I imagine he'll let them know about it, too."
"Bert?" Clark asked.
Vasco squirmed in his seat.
"I'm starting to worry. This is going faster than I expected. If Dariai didn't have other things to worry about, I'd be more worried."
"Like?" Chavez asked.
"Like he has a country to consolidate, and he has to know that if he starts rattling sabers, we'll react." The FSO paused.
"Sure as hell he wants to let his neighbors know who the big boy on the block is. How close is he to being able to do something?"
"Militarily?" the civilian analyst asked. He gestured to the guy from DIA.
"If we were not in the picture, no. But we are in the picture.
I ask now that you will join me in a moment of silence," Ryan told the audience in Topeka. It was 11 here. That made it noon back home. Next stop, Colorado Springs, then Sacramento, then, blessedly, home.
"You have to ask yourself what kind of man we have here," Keelty said in front of cameras of his own. "5 men and women dead, and he doesn't see the need for a law to control these guns. It's just beyond my comprehension how anyone can be as coldly heartless as that.
Well, if he doesn't care about those brave agents, I do. How many Americans will have to die before he sees the need for this? Will he have to actually lose a family member? I'm sorry, I